we made in March, Open Day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When the last American troop fled, the U.S. regime immediately froze $10 billion of Afghan sovereign funds, says Brecht Jonkers, journalist, in an article published under the heading Continuing War Against the Afghan People by Starvation. Here's the story. Two decades of occupation and invasion by the world's foremost arrogant and hegemonic power came to an ignominious and inglorious end in 2021. Ever since the attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. in September 2001, that had little to do with Afghanistan. Millions of Afghans have been punished for a crime they did not commit. By indulging in mass murder, ethnic cleansing, sexual violence, and the promotion of drug use, hundreds of thousands of Afghans died under horrible circumstances, and many millions more were subjected to indescribable cruelty. But even after the humiliating defeat inflicted on U.S.-led coalition forces in the longest war in U.S. history, the suffering of the Afghan people has not ended. When the last American troop fled with his tail between his legs, the U.S. regime immediately froze $10 billion of Afghan sovereign funds. Apparently, over 200,000 Afghan deaths were not enough to satiate the bloodlust of the imperialist cabal in Washington. This next step was in reality daylight robbery of the urgently needed money of what was already one of the poorest countries in the world. To say that every dime counts for the Afghan people is an underestimate. According to UN estimates, the after effects of two decades of constant war and occupation combined with current heavy sanctions against the Afghan people have left some 55% of all Afghans facing extreme hunger. That is 23 million innocent men, women and children who face the specter of death by starvation every single day. The U.S. stopped almost all foreign aid to the West Asian country, followed swiftly by EU, IMF and the World Bank. The result was that by the end of war, up to 80% of Afghanistan's annual income came exclusively from foreign aid. In a mind-boggling show of truly heartless immorality combined with despicable propaganda, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on February 11th to withdraw, read it, steal billions of Afghan Central Bank funds and siphon them for financial support for victims of 9/11 attacks. Indeed, Afghan money is taken away from war victims, widows and orphans in Afghanistan to be given to victims and survivors of a terrorist attack with which the Afghans had absolutely nothing to do. This financial attack against Kabul serves triple purpose. First, it continues the empire's war against the people of Afghanistan by plunging them further into famine and poverty without the U.S. needing to fire a single shot. Second, it creates easily accessible funds for the Democrats to donate to victims of terrorism in the United States, thereby funding their look at how much better than Trump VR agenda without actually needing to use America's own rapidly dwindling financial assets. And third, and most perversely, it plays on the subconscious and completely unjustified mental connection many people still make between 9/11 and Afghanistan. One of the most influential and yet somehow most hidden away lies that the imperial war machine has been drilling into the public's mind is that the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan was justified in the name of counterterrorism. The pointlessness of continuing what was, after all, the longest war in U.S. history by economic means has become clear even to some in the very halls of Washington, D.C. 40 House Democrats urged Biden in December to unfreeze Afghan financial assets and relax economic restrictions on Afghanistan. Maintaining this policy could cause more civilian deaths in the coming year than were lost in 20 years of war, the lawmakers wrote in their message to Biden. This calls to mind an analogy with the terrible consequences of Western economic sanctions on Syria, which has already led to a situation in which many people are suffering worse than during the period of actual military conflict. Britain's former Defense Chief General Sir David Richards echoed these sentiments with a surprisingly clear admission of his country's failure, saying, "I think this is the occasion for us to be magnanimous in defeat," Richards said. Former Afghan General Samer Sadat added that the Americans were strategically defeated in Afghanistan. They have to accept this defeat because the government that was the result of the 20-year presence of NATO and the U.S. collapsed in front of Americans' eyes. Deeply ingrained feelings of superiority and Western supremacy are, apparently, hard to let go even when faced with mountains of evidence to the contrary.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
The fires at Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah are burning after a brutal attack by the Yemeni army. Saudi Arabia has failed to put out the fire as of yet. This is while Yemen is marking 7 years of the bombing campaign and war by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and the Saudi-backed coalition. Will Saudi Arabia come to its senses and realize it is losing this war? Or does it need the green light from the U.S., which seems content to continue selling it arms? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me introduce our guests. Writer, journalist, and political analyst Hafsat Kara Mustafa joins us from London. Also joining us, political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell, who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. We need to talk about this and ask you your thoughts on this Yemeni operation that took place called Breaking the Siege 3, as they have called it. And it was executed against a number of vital and sensitive targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. They used domestically developed ballistic and winged missiles, as well as combat drones. And you had the strike today that involved that, and then you had the strike just days ago. Again, a number of installations to have been targeted. So what is your reaction to that? And please take into account, if you can for us, or to put into context, the advances made by the Yemeni army versus the Saudi-backed coalition, who has all these funds and all the resources that it needs to carry out the bombing campaign.
Well, yes. First of all, 7 years of this is intolerable, and we're adding humanitarian disaster upon humanitarian disaster around the world, and they're all manufactured. None of this is necessary. All this suffering. I think that the as I see what's happening in the last few days, and I speak as a pacifist, and I don't think there's a military solution to anything. But I also see that for all of the technology that's given and sold, and all the intelligence that the Saudis have at their disposal, and how they're carrying on this war with fantastic civilian casualties and attacking civilian infrastructure, and what's happening in these last few days with far fewer resources. Much more carefully orchestrated attacks on the oil infrastructure and other targets with very little collateral damage and that's really something remarkable. But I think one of the first questions you asked in this introduction is, will the Saudis be able to end this without a green light from the United States because of all the money that this is making for U.S. corporations? Just over a year ago, February, I believe the 7th of last year, President Biden made his first public address on after his election on foreign affairs, and he announced the great fanfare, we are ending all U.S. American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen. And he called it a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. He joined the world in condemning the horrible blockade and war of attrition against the Yemeni people. And immediately, that was stepped back from much more quietly, and much more quietly, millions of dollars worth of of sales have been approved, you know, of missiles made by Raytheon and other U.S. corporations to the Saudis. I don't think this is intended by the United States anyway. I hope that the Saudis have more sense for this to ever end at all. This is a status quo to be maintained because it's very profitable.
Well, Hafsakar Mostafa, looking at the media in the U.S., many portray this picture that there's confusion on the part of the Biden administration. I'm wondering what confusion there is, as our guest there said, where you have a president who comes out and said, I'm going to end the war. But in reality, what we're seeing in terms of action is more arms are being sold, the latest one being $750 million.
Well, I think we have to remember that this, for the U.S., is a perfect war. It's a war that generates a lot of money, but then doesn't generate a single U.S. Victim, a U.S. soldier being sacrificed on the battleground. So this is, in essence, a perfect conflict for a country that is war-hungry and whose economy is highly reliant on the industrial war complex. So I think there's absolutely no incentive for the U.S. government to put an end to it. On the contrary, it has all the incentive to pursue it, in particular as Saudi Arabia has a lot of money, will have even more money now that oil prices have gone up, and therefore will have the financial means to continue to buy arms and therefore continue to nourish this sector of the U.S. economy. So on the U.S. side, there is absolutely no incentive. And if anything else, they're going to encourage this conflict to continue. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that the Saudis really need to cut their losses. They started out in this conflict claiming that it would be a two-week thing, that it would be done within the end of the month. And obviously, 7 years on, here we are. And the Houthis are being more and more efficient, digging deeper in Saudi and actually targeting very, very sensitive areas. So I think what the best outcome would be for Saudi Arabia to realize that it hasn't made a single achievement, that it's not gaining any ground against the Houthis, and that in essence, today, it is very similar to what the U.S. was against the Afghans or against Vietnam, far more well-equipped, yet faced with a very, very determined opponent.
Brian Terrell, let me review this with you, because it's really something that needs to be reviewed. The strike that happened today, Yemen's army fired missiles and drones. Let's see here. The Saudi energy and water desalination facilities. It pounded high-value sites in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Energy facilities in the strategic Jizan and Nadran regions, Aramco's fuel distribution station in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah. Days ago, drone strikes hit a petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region, a natural gas plant, and you see where I'm going with this. So when you're sitting in the control room, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or in the U.S., what are they thinking? I mean, I'm wondering, when they spent all this money, all this technology, all the intelligence, and we hear a lot of it comes from the U.S., but they're suffering such losses. I mean, their jewel is Aramco. I'm guessing they should really put that into context and try to get some kind of political solution going immediately.
Yes, I think it is that urgent. It's that urgent to us and to all the people of the world. It's that urgent to the people of Saudi Arabia. It's that urgent as we're facing climate change, and we need to find alternatives and develop more efficient uses of the fuel that we have and find other fuels, we're spending all of our treasure on this. It's not a disaster if you are a major shareholder in Raytheon or in Boeing or some of these other corporations. It's seen as good news, as the CEO of Raytheon said back in February in response to the president's speech. He said, "Peace is not going to break out anytime soon." He assured the stockholders, and that he predicted that the Middle East would remain an area of solid, positive growth. This is how twisted it is that the people who have to gain from this see this. They don't see this in terms of human suffering, and they don't even see this in terms of bringing the world to the brink of a world war. They don't see this in terms of millions of people starving to death. They're seeing the bottom line, and it looks good. And there isn't any incentive to change course. And the whole world needs a radical shift in course. But we're not going to see it from the people who are running the military-industrial complex and the politicians here in the United States that they own.
Well, Hafsa Kamal Mustafa, since we're talking about this war, to have entered the eighth year, 7 years, is what we're also looking at in terms of its anniversary, which is a really depressing milestone. At some point, about 3 or 4 years into the war, there were reports that were coming out that the Saudi-led coalition at that point, there were a number of countries, it wasn't just the UAE and Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., that they were actually targeting infrastructure, whether it was agricultural infrastructure or infrastructure, for example, water, or the likes, which all point to the fact that they were trying to either starve the population or lead to the death of the civilians. Do you think that was one of the intentions behind the bombing campaign that happens, that they were actually going after the civilian population?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. And we also know that Saudi Arabia has committed actual war crimes under the very standard definition of war crimes. The idea, presumably politically, would be to carry out such punitive operations against civilians that the civilians would turn against their army and actually force it to stop. But that hasn't happened. If anything, it's sort of pushed many Yemenis who were perhaps on a middle ground actually more towards the Houthi operations, because they realize that they're being punished and they're being murdered and slaughtered at the hands of a very oppressive Saudi regime that has absolutely complete disregard for Yemeni, for fellow Arab and fellow Muslim life. And this is very interesting, because obviously this is a country that has very, very similar, very close ties historically, ethnically, religiously with Yemen, and yet it isn't hesitating in carrying out these very atrocious operations against essentially what is a brotherly nation. So I think that noticing and realizing that has actually pushed many civilians in Yemen to side with the Houthis, when prior to that they may not have been. So this, again, these operations have had the reverse effect of what Saudi Arabia was trying to achieve all those years ago. And so the harder they go on Yemen, the more losses they actually record on the strategic grounds.
Okay. Another point that is very interesting is that Yemen has come out in the past on a number of occasions, actually at this point, very recently, the Yemeni information minister coming out saying, you know, we're going to stop these missile strikes and our drone strikes on various targets in Saudi Arabia if the siege is lifted. Now, Saudi Arabia, for some reason, is not lifting that siege, Brian Terrell. It may be concerned about arms being transferred, perhaps, but that's a simple solution. I don't think that they're that incompetent to search UN-approved shipments that are supposed to be coming through into the territory and spread humanitarian, that is, goods to the Yemeni people. So why is it that that is not being done? Why is Saudi Arabia keen on keeping the siege?
Well, I think most of these problems that seem intractable have simple solutions. Like you said, that lifting that siege is a simple solution, and it could only lead to positive developments. I think we have to remember that this a few days ago, March 12th, that there was the Saudis carried out an execution, a mass execution of 81 men, women, and children. Even were beheaded by the Saudi kingdom. Some of them were specifically executed because they opposed the war in Yemen. And then 2 days later, the coalition invites the Yemeni leadership to come to Riyadh and for peace talks. And of course they're not going to come to Riyadh for peace talks. It was an absurd, obscene invitation, and showing that there isn't any on the side of the Saudi coalition any interest in peace, because of course they'd be risking their own lives by traveling to Saudi Arabia at the time. So any, there just isn't any, you know, this war would stop if there was a will to stop it. If there were the will on the part of the Saudis, a will on the part of the of the United States, there's certainly among the leadership in Yemen and the people of Yemen, they have every interest in stopping this war. And if that interest was met on the other side, it would simply end. These are not intractable problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, an interesting development came, Hafsa Qaar Mustafa, just hours ago, where prior to that you had the attack that happened by the Yemeni army on the Saudi oil facilities. But just a couple hours back, you had a major announcement. The way I'm looking at it, I'm not too sure if you agree or not, if you can tell us what it means. First, that the Ansarullah movement made an announcement that it will be suspending strikes in Saudi Arabia for a period of 3 days. So that's one of the statements they made. The other was that they were ready to release all war prisoners. What do you make of those two announcements?
Well, I think this is a position that implies that they've got the upper hand and the Saudis are in a weak position. And it's sort of allowing them to take stock of all the losses they've made and perhaps come back to the negotiating table and find a solution. Clearly, despite the gains, the military gains, I would say, on the Yemeni side, the losses on civilian and on infrastructure has been huge on the Yemeni side. And I think it's fair to say that obviously Yemen wants to see an end to this. So I think it is on the side of those who are making great military gains to actually tell the Saudis that this is your moment to take stock. Ramadan is coming up. This is a very unpopular conflict at the moment. And I think maybe, just maybe, if you take time to realize that you're gaining absolutely nothing from this, then you would take the wise decision. And I think it's sort of an appeal to wisdom over anything else.
I'd like to test your memory over here, if I may, Brian Terrell. Prior to the year 2015, when this war was launched, you had the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, to be cited as the number one threat, national security threat for the U.S. I don't know if you recall that. There was an incident that happened with U.S. sailors. And then there were reports that surfaced on more than one occasion in this war after it began, that you actually had the Saudi-backed coalition, which involves a lot of mercenaries also, but you had them fighting the AQ, the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, actually fighting alongside the coalition members on the ground. And many of the weapons that they had were American weapons, which as usual distributed to the UAE or Saudi Arabia or the coalition members, but ending up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Would you consider that one of the low points and also a sign of desperation in order to defeat the Yemeni army and the Ansarullah fighters?
Oh, yes. It's you know, it's an embarrassment. And we've seen the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, well, it didn't exist before the invasion of Iraq. These are the fruits of the war, so-called war on terrorism. Also, what's been happening since, for all these years too. Even before this war that began 7 years ago, the United States has been carrying on a war in Yemen with its own mercenaries and its drone attacks. That has been going on, consistently and. Undermining the democracy and the social, the civic and economic life of Yemen. So this has been Yemen has been a battleground, for different forces this is not Yemen's fight, but where the United States is often finding itself, very often finding itself, whether it's in Syria or Afghanistan, and Yemen supporting and profiting off of the different sides of these different conflicts and exacerbating them.
bit confusing, Hafsakar Mustafa, the relationship that the UAE and Saudi Arabia have in terms of their objectives, because we hear more about, for example, the UAE being involved with Israel because it has normalized ties with Israel. Socotra Island, supposedly, they have set up a spying center there, and they're really interested in the ports. Of course, they want to have some control over that Bab el-Mandab Strait, for example. And even at some point, there were clashes between the UAE-backed fighters and the other fighters backed by Saudi Arabia, I guess, if that's a correct interpretation. What are the objectives of the UAE that diverge from Saudi Arabia, in your opinion?
I think the UAE, because especially through Dubai, has become some sort of powerhouse, economic powerhouse, and a major financial and trading and touristic hub. It's actually trying to impose itself now politically. And there's no better way, in a way, than to impose yourself on the battleground and show that you are actually a force to be reckoned with. So I think because within the GCC groups, the main contender has always been Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has always flexed its muscle on the smaller countries of the region, this is the opportunity for the UAE to show that not only is it a more economical powerhouse, but actually it can even hold itself militarily. And obviously through its newly found alliance with the very powerful Israel that enjoys incredible military support from the US, I think it feels that now it can flex its muscle even more in terms of controlling certain major trading routes and actually imposing itself on as a military base of actual importance locally.
Okay, and Brian Terrell, we're quickly running out of time over here. I'm looking down a list of incidents that have been major in terms of the number of civilian casualties that have been killed, from whole entire families being wiped out. And many of these incidents that I'm looking at also cite U.S.-made weapons, obviously, that have been used. And then I'm looking at the U.S. President Joe Biden calling Putin a war criminal. I'm trying to put that into my logic here as to how he can call Putin that, yet we see what's unfolding in Yemen. What do you think?
Oh, don't stress yourself too hard on that, because you can't. I think also just the other day, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, made a speech about condemning the destructive behavior, reckless terrorist attacks by the Ansar Allah, by Yemen on Saudi Arabia, and of course he's not condemning the attacks of Saudi Arabia on Yemen. No, we're seeing a tremendous hypocrisy, and is horrific as and totally to be condemned. The Russian attack on Ukraine, to see it in the world context, it is, the United States and its allies and NATO have invaded many countries, created right now millions of refugees who are not being welcomed by the countries of Europe, not being welcomed by the United States, fomenting wars in economic disasters in Central America and South America, sure. And the refugees from those wars are starving in the desert sure. South of the United States, and their children are in cages. There are people drowning in the Mediterranean who are trying to escape the U.S. wars in Libya and in Syria. And I have many friends in Afghanistan who are trying to get out from those wars. So the hypocrisy of it is more than breathtaking. It's as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1967, he said that we have to face the fact that the United States is the biggest purveyor of violence in the world.
Okay.
And that wasn't popular then, and it's not popular now, even though it's more true now than it was in 1967.
30 seconds to you, Hafsakar Mustafa. Biden talks about a new world order, and it wants to lead it. Do you think that it will lead when it comes to ending this war?
Absolutely. I think we are facing a new world order, but perhaps not in the sense that Blinken wants it or imagines it. I think this war in Ukraine has revealed a lot of the hypocrisies and a lot of the double standards, and I think it is making people take stock, and we're seeing shifting grounds today. But I think for the Global South, it is actually shifting the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. Hafsakar Mustafa there, writer, journalist, and political analyst from London. Brian Terrell, thank you so much, political commentator and peace activist from Beloit, Iowa. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly, it's goodbye until next time.
Congratulations to everyone who celebrates Nowruz. We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, UN Expert Says Zionist Regime Practices Apartheid Against Palestinians. Here's more. The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians, and third states should support accountability efforts at international courts. So states Michael Link, an independent United Nations human rights expert from Canada, in a new report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva recently. Last year, that body voted in favor of establishing a permanent commission of inquiry into the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights in all the territory under its control, including inside the 1949 armistice line, demarcating the Zionist regime from the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime is nervous that the commission, led by three experts, whose report is expected to be published in June, will characterize it as an apartheid regime, according to a foreign ministry cable seen by the news publication Axios. Link's new periodic report, as a special rapporteur to the UN Human Rights Council, follows a handful of studies from high-profile Israeli and international human rights organizations, concluding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians, mainstreaming and aspects of what their Palestinian counterparts have been saying about the Zionist regime rule for decades. Acknowledging the seeming performance of the Zionist regime's military occupation, human rights groups are also calling for an approach centered on rights and accountability rather than moribund peace process towards a two-state solution championed by the United Nations and other entities complicit in the prolonged situation of injustice in Palestine. The Zionist regime has refused to cooperate with the Human Rights Council Commission of Inquiry and has denied entry and boycotted Link and experts who have previously held the role of a special rapporteur for human rights in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Link notes that, consistent with the mandate of the special rapporteur, his periodic report focuses on Israeli practices in the West Bank, including East al-Quds and Gaza. As such, he does not examine policy towards Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories or Palestinian refugees in exile, but acknowledges that Palestinian, Israeli, and international groups have concluded that it is impossible to have democracy here and apartheid there. Link observes that, by their very nature, occupations are required to be built with wood, not concrete. With the establishment of 300 Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank since 1967, and a massive wall built mostly on Palestinian land in the same territory, the Zionist regime occupation has involved a great amount of concrete. Meanwhile, in Gaza, for the past 15 years, Palestinians there have been barricaded into an open-air prison, Link states, adding a method of population control unique in the modern world. People in Gaza have endured four highly asymmetrical wars with the Zionist regime during that time, with enormous loss of human life and immense property destruction. The Zionist regime leaders have regularly and openly proclaimed that the regime's rule over the Palestinians and their land is permanent and that no Palestinian state will emerge, Link adds. The intent is for the Palestinians to be encased in a political ashery, a museum relic of 21st century colonialism. The human rights expert observes that an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression is at the heart of the Zionist regime's settler colonial project in Palestine. For example, Israelis residing in Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank enjoy comprehensive rights, while Palestinians in the same territory live under military rule and control. The Zionist regime settlement enterprise is meanwhile meant to demographically engineer an unlawful sovereignty claim through the annexation of territory. And because it is impossible for a colonial power to expropriate land and resources for its own population without also immiserating the indigenous people and triggering their perpetual rebellion, the Zionist regime has imposed increasingly harsh methods of control over Palestinians. The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza therefore pass the test of applicability of an international legal definition of apartheid, Link states. He observes that only the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1973, the Rome Statute providing the foundation of the International Criminal Court, drafted 25 years later, provide legal definitions for apartheid. A contemporary legal definition of apartheid drawn from and consistent with both the Convention and the Rome Statute would stipulate there exists an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression and discrimination, established with the intent to maintain the domination of one racial group over another, and which features inhumane acts committed as an integral part of the regime. All three features must be fulfilled for a situation to be considered one of apartheid, Link adds. Examples or patterns of racial discrimination by themselves are insufficient. The social construction of racial identity should be seen as a matter of perception, particularly in the eyes of a dominant group that distinguishes itself from other groups based on social markers such as nationality, ethnicity, religion, ancestry, and descent, Link says. In the case of the Zionist regime and the Palestinians, the former has determined the allocation and the denial of the rights in the occupied Palestinian territory through a series of laws, practices, and policies which define who is a Jew and who is not a Jew, according to Link. Under this system, the freedoms of one group are inextricably bound up in the subjugation of another. Palestinian human rights group welcomed Link's seminal report, the first by UN Special Rapporteur to definitely state that the Zionist regime practices apartheid. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime officials rejected Link's findings. Mariavi Elion-Sahar, the Zionist regime permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva, accused the independent expert of recycling baseless and outrageous libels. She added that Link aims to delegitimize and criminalize the regime of Israel for what it is, the state of Jewish people with equal rights for all citizens, she baselessly claimed. As Link notes in his report, however, the 5 million Palestinians under the Zionist regime military occupation are stateless and living without rights, in an acute state of subjugation and with no path to self-determination. And as for the more than 1.5 million Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, the lie of democracy is dispelled by Benjamin Netanyahu, whose office as prime minister ended last year after more than a decade, saying Israel is not a state of all citizens, but
the state of Jewish people and them alone. Women's role in making Nowruz happy. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Women are the symbol of generation, love, and prosperity in the Iranian culture. A woman spreads pure love and affection in the entire home. A mother spreads the red cloth eagerly. She is zealous as she wants to set the half-seen tablecloth in the best shape. She has already washed apples, cleaned the extra peels of garlic, prepared samanu pudding, sumac, oleaster, and vinegar, and has also green sprouts and put them on the tablecloth. She has also put a few coins in a small plate. Then she brings a mirror and a copy of the Noble Quran with hyacinth flowers. Then her daughter brings the fish bowl to complete the tablecloth. The mother hugs her daughter and smiles at her. There is a beautiful saying that when a mother smiles as if all bricks of the house smile, the joy and loveliness of every house depends on the woman in it. Although she is called as the fair sex, she is stronger than any man in spreading love and mercy at home. In verse 21 of chapter Rum of Quran, God says, "And of his signs is that he created for you mates from your own selves, that you may take comfort in them, and he ordained affection and mercy between you. There are indeed signs in that for a people who reflect." The verse that you just heard indicates that marriage is a sacred thing and God has ordained a special calm in marriage for man and woman. Anyway, one of the methods of women for creating calm at home is to make happy moments. This is more obvious in feasts such as Nowruz. Iranian women start their activities before the arrival of Nowruz. They first call on their husband and children, kindly help her clean the house. Then they put out any extra or useless item. This helps diminish stress and brings about tranquility. Women usually try to change the decoration of the house by changing the places of different things. They make various sweets and pastries. Women enthusiastically set the half-seen tablecloth, and some of them even do embroideries on the tablecloth. Some others make different dishes for the items of the tablecloth. A few women also make samanu for half-seen tablecloth. In short, it is women who make Nowruz happier and more memorable. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "No doubt, the role of a mother's skills as the administrator of home and family cannot be ignored for bringing about the spiritual serenity and the sense of liveliness." The administration of happiness at home is mainly the responsibility of parents, but a mother plays a more important role in this regard due to the management of the house affairs. She is the emotional support of the family. However, she needs the reciprocal emotions of family members. A mother is the access for everyone to confabulate. If the mother is happy, she can bring up happy and strong children. Nowruz is the best opportunity to consolidate family bonds and relations between children and parents. Yet, it is the mother who can act as pioneer. One of the problems of modern world for mothers is stress. Psychologists believe that the shortest way for making women happy is to decrease their stress. They maintain that man's supportive role for women and their mutual respect play a very important role in this connection. A man, via his all-out support for the family, particularly his wife, can remove her stress and provide her calm. Man's lovely word to his wife is very effective in decreasing of stress. Imam Reza, peace upon him, the 8th infallible successor of Prophet of Islam, says, "Whenever a man tells his wife, 'I love you,' a love will be created in the wife's heart, which will never get out of her heart. Verbal expression of love by man will light the fire of love in woman's heart. Then she will give this love to her husband and children. As it has been proved, mutual respect between couples will cause happiness in life. Politeness and respect will diminish stress and anxieties at home, and children will be brought up away from humiliation and disregard. Nowruz is the time for expression of love. At the moment of turn of the year, family members exchange kisses and give gifts to one another to increase love and happiness. In short, women play the most important and most beautiful role in creation of happiness in Nowruz and other times."